Welcome everybody to the Joint Senate and House Transportation Committee. We're having a presentation today by the Alaska Marine Highway. I'd like to introduce the members of the Senate that are here today, and if you would, Senator John Cowdery, who's the Vice Chair, is with us today. Appreciate that. Senator Olson, Senator Bill Willikowski, and Senator Wilkin. Thank you for being here. I'd like to also recognize Senator Elton, who's with us. And you're certainly welcome to take a chair at the table. And I.
Senator Thomas is here also.
Okay, good. Senator Thomas is here. And you're certainly welcome to come up and take a chair at the table if you would. I'd like to turn this over to the chairman of the House Transportation Committee to make his presentation of his members, if you would.
First of all, Vice Chair Newman. Representative Dugan, Faircloth, Salmon, and Representative Dahl is, again, welcome to join the table. She's present, and I don't see anybody else hiding out there, so that's it.
Thank you.
We're scheduled today from 1 to 3. It's a little bit after 1. We'll get started here, and if we have to schedule another meeting for this, we'd certainly be willing to do that. What I'd like to do right now is just go ahead and turn it over to the Marine Highway to new commissioner to introduce himself to us and to introduce his staff, if you would.
Now, keep in mind, this is my fourth day.
Good job so far.
Good job. Yeah, I'm still standing. Anyway, Chairman Kukich and Chairman Johansson and members of the committee, I am Leo von Shaven, Commissioner of Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. We are here today to provide you an overview of the Alaska Marine System. But before we do that, I would like to take a moment to introduce myself. I have met with Senator Kukich and Representative Johansson, but the rest I haven't met with you, and I plan to do that very soon. I'm a registered professional engineer and a registered land surveyor who has spent the majority of his career in the private sector. Fact is, I am the first DOT PF commissioner that I can think of that comes with such an extensive private sector background. Governor Palin wants a fresh approach to delivering essential government services in a transparent manner. She appointed me for my business sense and my commitment and my absolute belief in the importance of communications. And so I assure you today that this is what I intend to deliver you during my tenure, openly and honestly. And I promise I will always try to be polite. I want to share with you the business philosophy that has served me well through the private sector and which I want to bring to this job. I see these as five essential truths of a job well done. Client satisfaction, employee satisfaction, quality product, have fun, and manage the money. I've used those five principles in my career of 30 to 40 years in the private sector. I'm here to work cooperatively with you and the incredible dedicated team of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Now I want to introduce my team. John Torgerson, Deputy Commissioner for the Aviation and Acting Deputy Commissioner for the Alaska Marine Highway System. Captain John Falvey, General Manager of the Alaska Marine Highway System. Richard Leary, Business Manager of AMHS, Alaska Marine Highway System. Nancy Schlegel, Administrative Director for the Department. John McKinnon, Deputy Commissioner. Mary Soroki, Special Assistant to the Commissioner and Legislative Liaison. And Jim Beadle, AMHS Operating Manager. With that, I will slip out and bring these people forward. Thank you.
Commissioner, just to set the ground rules, would the gentlemen who are presenting and the ladies who are presenting be willing to take questions as we go on, or do you want to wait till after the presentations to have a question answer?
I think they would like to do the presentation and then wait for the end of it, because it's is that all right? I think that'll work okay with you all?
You're doing the overview to us,
yeah,
and we
think
appreciate
they
whatever you'd be comfortable with.
Wouldn't that be all right to have it presented first and then take the questions after? Okay.
We have a question first before.
Just a quick comment, Chair. I've known the Commissioner for several years. He comes from my hometown. and I've done some work for him, and when he says that he will try to be polite to the members, let me tell you, he's not afraid to lay down the law either, so he'll get her done.
Get her done.
Are there any more comments or questions before we ask the commissioner to ask his staff to step forward? If not, we're ready for your staff.
Thank you.
Chairman, can we notice Representative Corrine has joined us at the table? And while we're waiting for the guys to come up, I'd like to introduce Randy Rero as the transportation aide for the House. That's the guy you'll be dealing with, most of the people in this room.
I should introduce my aide as Nancy Barnes is over here to the left. She will be the person that you will be dealing with in scheduling, and any comments that you have to make to me through her, I'd appreciate it. Her and I are very new to this arena of being involved as chairmanship in the transportation, but we're going to do well. And Nancy is the person who does all the work, and I'll be there just as individual to do what she tells me to work with her, and she'll be doing a good job for all of us. And Randy, I've known for a lot of years, and I'm sure we're going to have a good relationship with the House too. So with that, we'll go ahead and I'll ask you to state your name for the record and give us your presentation, if you would.
My name is Richard Leary. I'm the Business Development Manager for AMHS.
Yes, so for the record, Captain John F. Falvey, Jr. I'm the General Manager of the Alaska Marine Highway System.
John Torgerson, Acting Deputy Commissioner of the Marine Highway System. Mr. Chairman, we're prepared today to give you the 30,000-foot view of the Alaska Marine Highway System. I heard your question to the commissioner about taking questions during this or going all the way through, and some of these might beg a question as we go through it. So from our perspective, I think you could, if there are questions on a particular slide, instead of running back and forth between the presentations, if the chair so wishes, then we would certainly take questions at any time that members
all right, well,
would
thank
like
you.
To like to offer that. It sometimes is easier than jumping back and forth between the pages.
Okay.
We start out with the AMHS mission statement. It's pretty straightforward. We want to provide safe, reliable, and efficient transportation of the people, the goods, the vehicles, throughout the entire Alaska Marine Highway System. This presentation, we're going to go through all the vessel status for you, where they're at, either operating or in a layup or overhaul or different things. We'll be going through a little bit of a budget, and we'll touch on some of the transportation plans as it relates to the Marine Highway System and implementing those.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, so what I'd like to do is just give a snapshot in time of where we are with our fleet. We have 11 vessels, and what I'd like to do is on the page you see here, I'm just going to go through each vessel quickly and just let you know where the ship is and what the ship is doing at this moment. The Matanuska, she is out running now. She's running out of Prince Rupert, in essence. We are turning her around in Juneau, which allows us to give Sitka a bit more service as opposed to taking the extra time running up the Lynn Canal. The Malaspina, she is in Todd Shipyard. She is undergoing a major federal capital project. She has been there for quite a few months, and she is due out in the middle of April. The Taku is also in a large federal capital overhaul project. She's also in Todd Shipyard, and she is due out in mid-July. Just to note, these are federal projects. These are projects that are bid on, and that's why both ships ended up in Todd Shipyard. So those are all bid on projects, different than the state funded 6-week capital projects. The Tustamina, she is in Seward Shipyard as we speak. She is undergoing her routine 6-week state capital overhaul, and she will be out in a few weeks. Everything's going well there. The Columbia is back on the Bellingham run. She runs up through the system, up through Lynn Canal. We did experience some problems with the Columbia. We had some generator problems. We had some steering gear problems, and she ended up at Alaska Ship and Dry Dock
for quite a few more months than we expected, but she now has three factory new generators, and the steering gear has been modified, and all systems functioning well on the Columbia. The Lakani, she's operating now as a day boat out of Juneau. I know there's probably a lot of questions about the Lakanti. Because of Coast Guard rules and regulations regarding work rest and the 12-hour day, we ended up modifying her routes, her schedules. If there's questions about that, I can get into the details of that a little bit later. The Aurora, she is running that triangular route in Prince William Sound. She runs to Cordova, Valdez, and Whittier. The Kennecott, she is off and running again. She had an extended stay also on Alaska Ship and Dry Dock. We had some hydraulic life-saving gear problems on the Kennecott. We are trying to work through some electrolysis problems that ship has right now. We think we're getting to the bottom of that. So she's off and running again. She's runs the circuit out of Prince Rupert. And now that the Tustamina is in Seward Shipyard, she picks up the slack between Homa and Kodiak, which she also does in the summertime when the Tusty runs out to the chain. The Kennecott running the Cross Gulf route has allowed us to double up service, in essence, Homer, Soldovia, Kodiak, and out to the chain with the Tustamina. So those areas, are experiencing more service than they have had in the past, and it's working out pretty nicely, and everybody up there seems to be pretty happy. The Latoya, she runs 5 days a week. She runs two runs a day from Metlakatla to Ketchikan, and she is doing very well, actually. Those routes are very full most of the time. In essence, you need a reservation to get on that boat now. So she's doing well. The Fairweather, she runs 4 days a week now. She'll run 7 days a week come summertime. In the summertime, she'll have three trips to Sitka in the summer, and she's doing okay. She's up and running. The Chiniga, she is in an extended layup in Ketchikan. We have warranty work that's going on with the Chiniga. We have experienced the same engine problems with the Chiniga that we had with the Fairweather. This amounted to cylinder corrosion due to a bad recommendation from the manufacturer regarding the type of coolant we used in the engines. These are very high horsepower engines. They are very lightweight, highly turbocharged. Coolant's very important. The manufacturer changed the coolant and caused corrosion. And we're also experiencing that now with the Chiniga. The engine manufacturer is aboard the boat now, and they are reboring the cylinders. So that process is underway. We still have ongoing reduction gear problems with...
I have a question from
Senator. Yes, sir.
Can you, which one of the so-called fast ferries is this?
The Chiniga, sir.
Yeah.
It's fast ferry.
Just one?
Two, and the Fairweather.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Mechanically, we are still, I'm sorry.
Another question.
Yes.
You mentioned that you've got one boat in the Ketchikan shipyard or work that goes through there, and then you're using the Todd shipyard for other ones. Is there more reasons why you don't use more of the Ketchikan, or where is the Todd shipyard?
It's in Seattle, and both the Malaspina and the Taku, those are federal projects. That's federal dollars. We get about $20 million a year from federal highways to do large maintenance projects. And the federal highways requires that those jobs are bid, and ASD did not bid on either one of those jobs.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Getting back to the fast ferries, we do have an ongoing problem with the reduction gears on both the boats. We have done some preliminary modifications to the Fairweather. We have employed an outside firm to do engineering analysis on the entire powertrain on both those vessels. The contractor, Director Shipyard, has done the same thing, and we are slowly zeroing in on what we think is the problem
and we will get it fixed. But we're not quite there yet. We don't want to make multiple fixes until we know for sure exactly what the reduction gear problems are. And we're getting close.
Senator Cogger has another
question. Yes, Senator. The fast ferries, how are they holding up in the rough seas?
We are doing okay in Lynn Canal in the wintertime. It tends to be not quite as rough as Clarence Strait would be, for example. We did run an experimental route with the Chenega last winter, not this one, but last winter, running from Ketchikan northward, and we did miss quite a few days because of weather. We missed quite a few days because of debris ingestion. There's a lot more logs in the water, so we had more problems running out of Ketchikan northbound through Clarence Strait. What we have found is, and we've kind of set this standard ourselves, if we have a 40 knot sustained wind, we stay at the dock. And we've just found that works out pretty nicely for us. And the boats tend to stay within their 95% reliability as far as weather-wise, and that's what we thought we were going to be up against. And in Lynn Canal, that's holding fairly true. But 40 knots of wind creates a sea condition that is not comfortable for the passengers. The boat can operate there, but it's not comfortable. And the captains have discovered that a little bit of a handling problem with, 40 knots of wind or more. So we've set that standard ourselves.
One more question. What is the draft of those?
9 feet, sir.
Compared to the other?
A mainline vessel? Yes. 20-ish. 20 feet, 23 feet, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's it for the fleet. If there's questions, I could take questions if
you know. Good.
Yep.
Are there any questions for the presenter here? If not, we'll go ahead. Oh, you have more, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair. You mentioned that on the engines of two of the ferries, it's a similar system, has to do with the corrosion around the cylinders and the coolant that's used. I'm assuming, what type of recall does the state have to go back on the manufacturer? Who's covering that cost? If you're using what they have in a recommended coolant, or what they recommended, and now we're having an engine problem, who's paying for that?
The manufacturer has paid to rebore the Fairweather. There is over $1 million. They're also paying to rebore the Chenega. The problem comes in the fact that when you take, for example, two passes on the cylinders, and that's where we're at now, legally you can take three, and the block really is no good. The service life of the engines has been reduced, and we are working very closely with the AG's office and Director Shipyard and the manufacturer to come to some conclusion beyond just having spend $1 million for each of the boats to fix the engine, because we are worried about the life of the engines now.
They can't re-sleeve those?
Well, yes, we have, but if there is any further corrosion, you can only take so many passes on the cylinders before you have to start with a new block.
Thank you, Chair.
And legally right now it's three passes, and we've made two passes on those cylinders.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of unusual that the coolant would get inside the cylinder. It must have been something pretty catastrophic that happened for that to go on. Usually the coolant is outside the combustion chamber.
Well, not being not being an engineer, I really couldn't answer that, but I could get that answer for you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Interesting, yeah.
But it was a coolant problem with the cylinders causing excessive corrosion, rust, if you will, inside the cylinders, and that's what happened.
Representative Johansson has a question for you.
Captain Falvey, looking at the fleet profile here, I see there's four vessels that are actually older than the youngest senator at the table here. Can you give an overall just kind of how you feel about the fleet? It seems like you've got old ships. They've got to be, if I've got an old 62 truck, I spend a lot of time and money fixing it. Can you just kind of get into how you feel about the fleet, the age, and challenges that you face?
Well, as you can see, the ships are old, and I use the analogy, you bring an old car into the shop, and it's just one problem after another. You find new problems. We did a study, if you will, regarding service life
you know, of the ships, oh, about 4 or 5 years ago. And what came from the study was they have a hull life of, say, for example, 60 years. Okay, well, what that means is it's going to stay floating for 60 years, but it is very challenging to mechanically keep the guts of the ship intact and running and operating as it gets as they get older and older and older. We are somewhere in the vicinity of $16 million of deferred maintenance. You know, maintenance that we defer, we do what we have to do, we defer. You know, what we need is some recapitalization, and we do need some new ships. And I think that we can, you know, operate much more efficiently. If I were to be asked, well, how can we be efficient? We do need new ships. We need new tonnage. We need ships that are more efficient. We've got to be very intelligent what we decide to build, but. You know, newer ships are going to be a lot cheaper to maintain, technically, and a lot more efficient to run. They're more automated in essence, and the ships are old. And a perfect example, we got the, you know, Columbia into the yard, and she stayed there for 5 months. The Kennecott, months. The Lacani, steering gear condemned, months. The Lacani, she's going to be laid up again because the repairs on the steering gear failed again, so she's gone down again for a few weeks. They're old, they're getting older, and it's just gonna cost more and more money to try to keep them going. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Senator Cowdery,
what is the engine life expectancy? How many hours on the fast ferries?
Well, what they do is they categorize it in hours before major overhauls. I mean, technically the engines will you know last a long, long time, but I think that's somewhere up around 20,000 to 30,000 hours.
Thank you.
Yes.
If you don't burn them up.
Out yes, sir. Right.
Fuel or oil or something.
Right. Okay. Okay, going on to the next slide here, what we want to do is just give you an overview of the system. I'm sure everyone knows how large it is, but, you know, southeast, southwest, these are the ports that that we call at. There's 32 of them. I believe 17 of them we actually manage ourselves that are our state facilities, but this just gives you an overview of how large the system is, 3,500 miles. And the next plate just kind of shows where we go and what it looks like. And the next one after that, the Southwest system. And I think it's important to note that you know, the Southwest system in general has gotten a lot more service right now than they've had in the past, and I think our customers are pretty happy with what's happening out in that area. We've still got some work to do in the southeast, and we know that.
The next slide, we present over a four-year period, specifically from 05 to 06, the increased departures or port calls by the three major areas as guided by the transportation plans. I think what we'd like to point out here is that...
I know we switched from one speaker to another. Just for the record, could you just identify yourself?
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Richard Leary, Business Development Manager. What we'd like to point out is the almost uniform growth from 05 to 06 in all the areas. The system is growing by service or port of calls throughout the system. This slide deals with passengers, characterizing 05 and 06 calendar years. As you can see, we incurred roughly in total about a 10% increase in passenger volume. Just slight increases in the southeast portion with major increases in both Ross Gulf service and the Prince William Sound service.
Representative Newman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we're looking at the calendar year for vessel departures to the service areas, and then we go to traffic comparison. How do we put those two charts together so that we can look and see what passenger traffic is per departure area in the, are those, I guess what I'm trying to get at, are those boats full, are those vessels full, are they 70% full, summer, winter, how do we correlate those two together?
We could provide you with what we call capacity listings, the usage of our assets by, you know, various service areas, and we could divide that by summer and winter. That's
thank you, Chair.
Okay.
You can provide that to the Chair so we can send it out to our
Representative Dugan, you have a follow-up question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. So can you give us an idea, looking at the passenger traffic in any of these years, what percentage of that would be resident traffic and what would be tourist traffic?
I know we can for the, oh, excuse me, through the chair. I know we can for the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. We do have a slide that addresses a little bit of that coming up in the show.
Okay.
And
through the chair, I think it's important to note that you know, we have done some tracking of who these people are, and what we have done, and I think what has turned this downward, you know, spiral of ridership since 1992, which was our last big year, is you know, we do know that Alaskans are price sensitive, and we know that, and the implementation of the 30% round trip discounting in the winter with the driver going free, that we believe is where we've turned this we've turned the tables on it. Okay, we've also got a new marketing plan where we had secured $700,000 over X amount of years of general fund for marketing. We have a very aggressive marketing plan. We are working with Bradley Reed and Anchorage, and we're targeting, you know, certain groups and areas, and we feel that's helping. But the Alaskans riding the system in the winter, we feel is turning these numbers around, and it's the round trip discount that's doing it. Yeah. Well, we're pretty confident about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next slide here is the same presentation with tracking vehicles as compared to passengers. The increase hasn't been as great on the vehicle side as the passenger side. We view, you know, targeting vehicles as basically free money for us, and our marketing emphasis is to try to fill that car deck. Is the outlay of cash is the same whether you're traveling with a car deck full or with it empty. We talked about traffic levels. Now we'd like to just show a brief scenario on where our revenues have gone. We had a nice bump from 05 to 06 of over 10%. We cracked the 50 million mark by, you know, quite a margin there. And of course, this year our goal is much bigger than that. We are striving to hit that.
Through the chair, Captain Falvey. This slide, just in essence, we wanted to just show you our passenger survey results as far as satisfaction. These surveys were done by a third party. I apologize, I don't have the name of the surveying organization, but this was a third party survey, very very recent survey, and you know, it does show that satisfactory, good, and excellent dominates the pie chart here in the various areas that in essence were surveyed. The terminals, they do a good job in the terminals, and we've got wonderful crews that love what they do, and they do a good job out there running the ships, and these surveys show that. And I frequently get letters from all kinds of passengers just saying, this crew member went above and beyond, and they really helped me out. And so we've got good crews out running our ships. They like their jobs, and this shows that they're giving our passengers good service.
Richard Lurie. This next pie chart divvies up the FY06 realized revenues by the passenger's place of residence. In FY06, 67 or 2/3 of our passengers were Alaskans, and those people generated 51% of our revenues. The next biggest component is, of course, is the lower 48, which provides about 46% of our revenues on only 30% of our passengers. Those primarily are passengers visiting us through Bellingham. Canada is a pretty small portion of the pie, 4% of our passengers, resulting in 3% of our revenues, and foreign visitors are just a small speck.
Mr. Chairman, John Ferguson. Another important part of our survey was to find out where our customers were going, what their final destination was. This slide shows that the Alaska Marine Highway System is more than just coastal Alaska. It services the entire state. And you can look at the different regions that we have and total those up. The southeast portion there, which would be your Sitka, Skagway, Juneau, Haines, the green part, is about 36% of the total volume. Their final destination was somewhere in southeast. The interior, Fairbanks, Denali, and Tope, 29%. And again, the message, the take-home part of this message is that it's not just a coastal highway system, that it services the entire area. The Kenai, Anchorage, Palmer, Talkeetna, Valdez, Copper Basin is 33%, our second largest destination, South Central Alaska. And then the others, the far north, which would be north of the Arctic Circle, or north of Fairbanks, excuse me, which is probably north of the Arctic Circle, but a very small percent, and then southwest is even a smaller percent. Well, this is a pretty telling chart to us about our service levels and what our final destinations of our passengers are.
Representative Hansen has a comment, and then Senator Olson.
I just wanted to agree with Senator Ferguson. I can't help it. But I think this is very telling, and this is one graph that it's almost like it's been a secret. It's always been difficult for us in Southeast and Southwest to enjoy the ferry service. We see the boats every day. But to find out where these people are actually going, I think it's very important for the folks from the interior to understand the contribution to the economy that this system spreads across the state. A lot of these people are rubber tire traffic. They're the people who come in with their RVs and spend a week in these different places, and they spend money. They go to stores, they go to shows, and it's a real important part of our economy, I believe. So I think this is a very telling graph. And also I think you know, who these people are. A lot of them are locals, a lot of them are tourists. One thing that I learned in the last couple of days is a lot of these people are military folks who are transferring up to the bases in the interior. And maybe you could talk a little bit about, I think, the Cross Gulf, when the Kennecott goes across, many times there's a lot of military folks. I don't know if that's coming up, or maybe you could just comment on who these people are.
Yes, through the chair, Captain Falvey. A lot of military, probably more so in the summer, although we do carry some in the wintertime. And we do know that they originate out of Bellingham, most likely on the Columbia, and they make the switch in Juneau, and then we bring them on into Whittier. And it is a very, very large volume. We could get that number. I don't know if you have it with you, but it's families. It's military families moving to and from the bases in the interior. And it's a large figure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Olson.
Senator Torgerson, is this, this is an 05 chart, and you compared that to the 06 chart that was the slide before. Is it pretty much the same distribution where you got 50% resident and 50% non-resident going to these end destinations?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, Senator Olson. I understand the two charts are not the same fiscal year, but we this has been the case for years as far as the final destination of our passengers since we started. And the first time I saw this was a while back, maybe about 10 years ago, is one of the tracking things that we all wanted to know when we were working on budgets and different things, who our customer actually is, where they're coming from, what the final destinations are. So what we learned, if you take the other pie chart, is 67% of the travelers on the system are Alaskans. And then you go to the 05 data and you apply that many of those Alaskans are going more than just to the southeast region, they're going all over the state. So we look at this as, you know, the connectivity between the water and the road system. You know, we really are taking people to the different road systems, which you can see by that data.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Go ahead with your presentation.
Okay, the next slide, we just wanted to mention a little bit about the core schedule. It's been a topic for a long time, I guess, about developing the core schedule, but one of the things that we're very focused on, we want to present to the legislature and Southeast Conference and the communities in Southeast, or the communities that we serve, and primarily it would be, you know, what is the minimum level of service? As we all know, we have ups and downs of operating the ships based upon the cost, based upon appropriations, and other outside pressures that are beyond the purview of Captain Falvey or Richard Leary. So you take an amount of money and you run the system. We would really like to get to a minimum core level that we could all agree to that. This is the bottom line. We're going to go to these communities at this level. Wouldn't be maybe necessarily one that would be what a lot of communities want, but at least you could count on the vessels being there and performing that service, and then that would be our goal, you know, to keep that minimum level service. And then as you folks deliberate and maybe put more money into it, then we would add to that minimum level. The other piece of this slide is that the Southeast Conference is going to have a workshop on February 13th, and they're going to, along with AMHS staff, are going to start looking at a core schedule and seeing what community buy-in they can get going through their organization instead of from ours down to theirs. So we look forward to that presentation and working with the Southeast Conference.
I guess we're getting here now, Chair. I was just looking at the, thank you, Chair. We're looking at the OAGF request of $235.3 million. But we don't have an idea, I guess maybe on the next page, how much money did you receive in receipt account or receipt authority, and how many people this serves?
Well, you skip a page and go to the 08 budget, I guess. The 07 budget was somewhat less than this, somewhere around $133 million, with receipt authority of $54 million. And the 08 budget, of course, is what's stated right there. $98 million is our general fund request, and receipt authority of $52.5.
Thank you, Chair.
So if I could back up to page 15, I had this slide incorporated in here to show this is the entire DOT general fund request. And as it relates to DOT and the Marine Highway System and others, the facilities and so forth. And we just want to, as you all know, the governor has asked all of the departments of state government to reduce by $150 million from the operations. And DOT's portion of that is was allocated out was $21.3 million. So I wanted to show this right here and put that on the record about the level of reductions that DOT is looking at. We don't have those here today because they're being reviewed and massaged. And as you heard from our commissioner, he's only been on at work a little bit of time, and we have to work all this stuff through. But the take-home piece is that although it's a $235 million reduction or general fund request, that we are going to be asked to reduce that.
Representative Newman,
Thank you, Chair, and I don't mean to seem like I'm taking all the, asking a lot of questions here, but currently there's being a ship built in Ketchikan for the Mat-Su that will serve Anchorage to Mat-Su. Is that going to be part of the Marine Highway System? And if so, how's that going to affect your budget? Do you feel it's going to run at capacity? Is it, if not, how much, what is the positive or negative effect on that? Could you kind of give us a short view of how that's going to affect the ferry system and how that's going to work?
When short answer, no effect. It's being operated by Mat-Su, and Marine Highway is not going to be involved in that. That's the ship that's currently being built down in the Ketchikan shipyard. What do they call it? E-craft?
Yes, through the chair, Captain Falvey. It's called the E-craft. It's an experimental craft being built for the Navy as an experiment, if you will, but it will also be used in service also, and it'll do some dual purpose. It'll do some Navy experimenting, plus it'll carry passengers also. But we will not be operating that vessel.
So quickly, maybe you don't know the answer to this, but so basically the cost of operating that's going to fall upon the Mat-Su Borough or the Navy?
It's my understanding through the chair, Representative.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wilken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had some questions for when they finish, but this is a good time to ask one. On the slide, this slide here, when I was looking at this, I remember a discussion we had last year with finance. And I went back and found the chart that we had that was so revealing last year. So for the committee's information, and you can draw conclusions as you wish, but if you just look at the green piece of the pie, the 105.5, this is the general fund request. And the way the Federal Highway System measures our miles, they tell us that is the, we traveled 2.4 billion miles traveled. And we spend $105.5 million to support that travel. So that's 99.1% of the miles traveled in our state. Marine Highway System, we spend, in this case here, $91 million, and we travel 23 million miles. So half of the general fund component for maintenance operations for our highways versus our Marine Highway System, half of it goes to support 0.9% of the miles traveled, and the other half goes to support 99.1% of the miles traveled. Now, you can draw what conclusions you'd like, but my conclusion is there's a better way to get people from A to B rather than the Marine Highway System, and I'll just leave that for now and perhaps come back later. But I remember that from last year because that was very surprising to many of us, and I thought it would be appropriate to bring that out for the committee.
Thank you, Senator Wilken. Any comments? Representative Johansson.
I just want to, first of all, recognize Representative Johnson has joined us for the record. Thank you very much.
Let's go ahead with the presentation.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the next slide is basically our 08 budget request. The total authority of a 152.4. General fund 98.1, receipt fare box money, we anticipate raising 52.5, and then there's some CIP funds that'll come out of that of 1.8 million. That's
Richard Leary. Mr. Chairman, this slide, I hope everybody has a handout. This is rather busy, I guess. What we want to do here is slice and dice the numbers and put them in a what we call a self-financing percentage by service areas or service routes. So we've divided this by boat and listing the service route. The first column of numbers broken out by summer and winter are the weeks of service that service route is being serviced by that vessel. The next two columns are the average weekly revenues that are brought in and the average weekly expenditures that it takes to run that boat on that route. And the final column is the what portion of our bills are we able to pay through the funds we generate, with the corresponding offset being the subsidy required A couple things certainly jump out. Number one, you don't see any at 100% level. You know, the highs are the 70%, down to the lows in the high teens. You certainly see the areas that are more favorable in the summer versus the winter, and the areas that are basically flat as to financing levels throughout the seasons. This particular year, Columbia, which is traditionally our biggest revenue generator, is in a long-term CIP project for the entirety of the winter season, and that's why it's just running during the summer.
Next slide, through the chair, Captain Falvey. What we have here over the next few pages are the three transportation plans that do exist right now, the Southeast, the Southwest, and the Prince William Sound plan. This first plate basically just gives you, you know, a little bit of background as to the plans, the reason for the plans. You know, I think we've got some work to do with the Southeast plan. That was structured around fast ferries. I think we need to decide if we're going to continue forward with fast ferries. When this concept first came about, fuel was much cheaper than it is now. We have to realize that a very high percentage of the overall operating cost of a fast ferry is buried in fuel. We know that. So that's something we need to look very, you know, very hard at when we start talking about new tonnage, new ships. You know, should they be fast ferries? Should they be fast ferries that are not built under the high-speed code, which is very expensive to operate under? Should they be more conventional fast ferries that are potentially cheaper to operate, maybe smaller? So we need to consider that going forward, and that's a big challenge for us. Once again, the Southeast plan, we broke each plan down here just talking about the whole concept of the roads to connecting shuttles. And that has not changed. And I guess the question is that connecting shuttle a fast ferry or a conventional shuttle ferry? And that's where I think we need to go forward into the future with. The Prince William Sound plan and the Southwest plan have in essence been implemented as far as the expected service levels that these plans called for. We are basically there with these plans. The fact that we're running the Aurora and the Chenega in Prince William Sound and the Kennecott coming across Gulf, you know, into the Whittier area has freed up the Tustamina to double service on the chain and in Lower Cook Inlet. And so we're at the service levels that these plans call for. We still have some work to do on the Southeast plan, and we do know that. Okay, John, you want to finish up?
Mr. Chairman, won't go to that last slide. This basically wraps up our presentation for your committee. The take-home pieces that we put together for the last slide is basically we have an aging fleet, the boats are starting to get expensive to operate, or they have been for a while expensive to operate. The large crews is mainly comparing mainline to shuttle vessels. Some of the mainliners are 50 and 55 people on a crew, and the Fairweather, for example, is 10. And that was part of the Southeast plan, was to implement these shuttles to, you know, in between the different communities, so we wouldn't be running the mainliners as much. We are still waiting construction of roads and the shuttles so we can implement the rest of the Southeast plan. And then of the three that Captain Falvey just discussed, we're pretty much well along in implementing Prince William Sound. It did call for another fast ferry up there, and as you said, we're still waiting to see what we do with that. Southwest plan called for the Testamina to do exactly what it's doing and run down here more than it had been in the past, and that's currently what's happening. And the Southeast plan, again, we're waiting on some of the roads to be built and some of the interconnecting pieces, and then the shuttle ferries that will connect that road system. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, we have quite a team assembled here. If there's any questions, we'd be glad to answer them and try our best to bring back answers to you at a later time.
Are there questions from the committee? Yes, please.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. On the FY08 budget, you have the Columbia not operating in the winter, and yet you still have revenues. Am I missing something?
That number is basically what it would be if it was operating during that time. You're right, it's not operating. Excuse me, Richard Leary. I'm sorry.
And the expenses is the same?
No. Correct.
I mean,
Mr. Johnson, we're showing here, the 08 operating budget shows it operating the 21.3 weeks, but if it was running, the weekly revenue would be that, and the weekly expenses, it doesn't change much from summer to winter on the expenses. The Columbia is going into another major overhaul through the winter months. That's why she's shown not running here in the Taku and the map are taking its place.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, the handout I have actually has revenues where there you don't, so. So that's my
operator error.
Okay, well that I can relate to. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Wilkin, Senator Cowdery, Senator Wilkin.
Thank you. I have a number of questions. Could I just march down through them with your indulgence? Could we look at slide 4, ports of call? You know, there's always a cry in this building when folks come to visit from Southeast that we want more ferry service and we want it more often, and of course we want it cheaper, but. So I compare that to where Representative Sam and Senator Olson, where I'm from. We have places on the Yukon, for instance, that if you don't get your stuff in by September, you don't get it until next May, that are totally bound by that schedule. Are there any places on these ports of call that the Alaska Marine Highway System is the only service provider?
That's something we'd have to get back to you on.
Okay.
Kevin Fowley.
Okay. And by looking at it and what little I know about this, I would say no, that any place that is shown on this list has not only a state ferry going to it, but also has some alternative. Has the state done an analysis of the cost of getting people, or probably relevant materials from point A to point B on a ferry system versus a private barge? In other words, if we were going to ship a car from Seattle to Angoon or from Juneau to Angoon, when someone in Angoon looks at that, what is the cost to do it by our state system versus a private barge system? Have we ever looked at that?
Through the chair, Captain Falvey. Jim Beadle, our operations manager, was sitting in the back here. He did look into shipping costs, let's say, for example, from Bellingham up through into Prince William Sound. And
let me try that. Through the chair, Senator Wilkins, a couple of years ago we did a pretty in-depth rate study. I'm not sure Angoon was on the list. I think we were the larger communities. I don't remember much of it, but it has been done. We used that to set our rates. We went through quite a period there, and we did raise some. I believe we ended up lowering a couple, but we did compare airlines, moving passengers by airline, by the charter services that were here, or consultant, and also barging on moving supplies and goods. We have that report, and I'd be glad to get it to the committee.
So is it safe to say that in any of those communities that the price is really not the determinant on whether I'm going to ship my car or ship myself on the ferry? It's more schedule and whether I want to travel with my car. from what you've just said, that seems to me that you're not driven by price, you're driven by schedule.
Well, through the chair, I'm not sure I said that way.
Okay.
Price is important. Price is important to everyone, even if you're taking a cab from one place to another. Not that you have, you know, those are controlled by government regulations, so they're all the same. But the urgency to go somewhere, what you're hauling, if it can go in an airplane versus can it go in a boat, if it's your vehicle. I mean, there's a lot of different decisions that go into the consumer to make that decision. So I'm not sure if that answers your question or not, but it isn't quite as cut and dry as what you were putting in.
And maybe I'm a little more oblique than I need to be. So the way I see it is that there's been the cry for increased service. And as you, some of your charts here, which we'll look at in a minute, you responded to that.
Yes.
But what's missing in this is the subsidy that the state is, what is costing the state to increase, what amounts to incremental increase to satisfy that service level. And that if we say to someone, well, the ferry won't be there Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, but it will be there every Monday, it doesn't leave those folks destitute like they are with Woody's people, where you just have to wait a week. You don't have to wait 8 months. So the point is that they have alternatives out there. And that to answer the cry with the people's money that we want more service more often may or may not be appropriate given what this table and this building thinks is an appropriate level of service for the people's money that's been asked. So I'll just leave it at that. And so speaking to that, then, if we look at slide 10, or really it's 8 and 10, when I came here, I remember, because I'm from the interior of Alaska, I'm a flatlander, and I remember that at that time, $30 million is what it cost us, to people's money, to support the ferry system. Last year it was 90-some, and I see now it's close to $100 million. I think what would be helpful, Mr. Chairman, for the committee and for you folks to put together is the subsidy for the last 10 years, how it's grown. And I think we'll see the slope in the last 3 years, albeit a lot of it's fuel costs, I understand that, but the slope in the last 3 years is extraordinary. And as we talked about last year, if we think that we're going to, I don't think the people of Alaska are ready to talk about $110 million next year and $130 million the following year. The ferry system is truly at a point where, given an aging fleet, given the propensity of this table to not continue to pour money into this system, that, in my opinion, is broken, alternatives that people have in travel, aviation, remember, when this fleet was put together, there was no such thing as a cruise ship in Southeast Alaska. When people wanted to come from Iowa to come to Alaska, they got on the state ferry system. They don't do that anymore. They get on Princess. So there's all these factors that just sort of spin this thing down, and what we're trying to do is we're trying to lift it up with people's money. And we're at a point where we need to decide how this ferry system is going to operate, because we can't afford a system that takes half of the maintenance operation monies for less than 1% of the miles traveled. And that won't be fixed in a year, but it may be fixed over a generation, but it won't be unless we start today. So I'm asking for the subsidy, Mr. Chairman, that we could, that the committee could have. It's a finance issue, but it's very relevant to where this system is today. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilkins, I don't disagree with the philosophy. And when you look at straight line numbers of where it was 10 years ago and where it is today, it's a very major increase. But when I believe what you'll find, and we'll certainly give you the 10-year look, but we'd also like to provide you with why that cost has went up. 9/11, the security at these ports and on these vessels has added about $8 million to the operating costs since September of 2001. The fuel costs are just totally unpredictable. Somewhere around $15 million. I believe you guys, most of the legislature was involved in the fuel triggers and all the rest of that. There's about $15 million more. PERS. We show PERS into our operating budget instead of it being broken out, or instead of being lumped like many of the other departments are. You just have a one line. Since we're a transportation enterprise, I guess, that we show that differently. And I think in some degree, labor increases for labor contracts added probably about another $8 or $9 million. So I believe when you look at this, that that although a large increase in general fund dollars, that some of that will be justifiable through other issues that are beyond us. Now, I'm not trying to diminish your message, and that is that we have choices to make, and we might have a limited resource called general fund dollars. And we currently are into that, about the $150 million reduction. We're back to making, choices, and we're gonna help you do that. Hopefully we'll be able to advocate it enough for the system to keep it operating and provide back to this core level service or above.
And I think it'd be helpful to have the dollar amount, just the raw dollar, but also percent of budget. If the subsidy is growing or diminishing as a percent of the GF request.
Yes, sir.
So that, if we look at the slide 19, the budget itself, I have the pleasure for the last 25 years of having a small cabin out in Prince William Sound. It's very small. It's so small you got to walk outside to change your mind. But nonetheless, it looks out over the tanker route, and of course it looks out. We go in and out of Valdez, so I see the Chenega. And so for the last 2 years, certainly last year, the Chenega chugs in every day, or flies in, pardon me, because it almost ran over me once, which is another story. And my lawyer will talk to you about that. He said, "Gary, you really ought to have your radio on." I said, "Yeah, probably." So, it flies in and out, but then I also see the Aurora chugging in and out, just maybe the same day it goes in and out. And so I was going to ask, and I see it here. I'd like to know for the last 2 years, the utilization of the Chenega and the Aurora in load capacities, percentages for passenger and vessel. And I had a sense that they weren't doing very well. And if you look at 19, just from these raw numbers, they're not doing very well at all. The Chenega and Prince William Sound, which is the one I see flying back and forth, is the least self-financed one in the whole route. So I'm wondering, why are we running in and out every day? And then the second question is, if we're doing that, why do we have a mainliner following up behind? I could see if it was full, but of course it doesn't look to be full. So I think that would be helpful to see that. And I remember at one time the Chenega, it's home ported in Cordova.
It, on the back of the ship, it has Cordova. It's actually the change port is in Ketchikan.
It is, but in the summer, where do the crew changes and where does it spend the night?
Through the chair, it's Captain Falvey, in Cordova.
Cordova.
Yes, sir.
Is there a reason why you would have it where there is no road? How did it end up in Cordova? And isn't that the most, if it goes Cordova, Valdez, Whittier, why wouldn't you port it in a place where people can get to and from in a car?
Through the chair, that decision was made many, many years ago, with the Prince William Sound plan, and I think it was because there was no road there.
Oh, okay. So one of the, maybe, that's a project for the new commissioner to figure out why we would put that home port, the ferry, in what I would think is the most expensive place in the triangle. So anyway, if you'd get that, I think that would be very, very interesting. And I think this chart backs it up that perhaps there's a better way to run the Chenega and the Prince William Sound plan. Then my last one. Yes. Last year, when we were talking about the ferry system and kind of having the same, very, very same discussion in finance, we were presented a chart, and it showed the Southeast Archipelago, and it showed the transportation plan, and it had the little 20-mile roads connected to to what I think somebody called the Latuya model, and it just, a little ferry chugged over here and it hooked up to another road, chugged ahead, and all the mainliners weren't a part of that. I think it would be helpful for us, Mr. Chairman, to have that in front of us so you can see what I happen to think the Latuya model happens to be the road to the future, and that is these little connectors with connecting ferries that are day boats, and the liners, you may have one liner hauling tourists out of Bellingham, but you don't have them hauling Alaskans. And that would be helpful just to visualize that, because that really brought it to me. I said, oh, that's where we're headed. And it takes, you know, it takes a few roads and takes 20 years, but it doesn't happen unless it starts here. And given this for subsidy, you know, given this for ridership, we've got to do something. We have to do something different, because what we've done, where we are today, is clearly broken. And that may be something for all of us to look at sometime. But could we get that again? That was really enlightening.
Clearly, that's the Southeast plan that I don't believe any of us at this end of the table can take credit for. That was part of, I think, many Southeast plans as they go through the planning process, is to have roads and connectors and some other things. We all know there's difficulties in getting permits for roads and these kind of things, and it's being worked on. Not that I can use that for an excuse for you, that why we need more general fund or keep the system going, but it's an actual real thing. We just can't walk down there and lower the blade and build a road. We have to go through all the processes, and they're frustrating and best, particularly when you're looking at the increase in general fund money that it takes to go around these islands instead of across them.
Thank you. And my last question is we have been the beneficiaries of federal money. Is there any significant federal money for additional fleet either modifications or additions?
Well, Senator Wilkins, of course, there's no federal money that goes into operations. You're just talking about new vessels. There are some, is the short answer. It's not as much as what we need to build out to an entire system. I believe we have a couple shuttle ferries in the plan over the next few years, if we can get these roads built, and they keep going out farther, because an interconnecting system, you've got to have both ends of it to make it work. If it all happened today, is there enough money in there? I mean, all the road connections? No, we'd have to go back and ask Congress for, you know, additional funding for that, or come up with some other creative ways of doing that. The last time I looked, I think the total build-out was something like $700 million or something. I mean, it's a lot of money, and the entire highway and marine highway federal funding is, I believe, $280 million or whatever. So we would have to go back and get some additional.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chairman, thank you. This is really a huge issue, and we looked under the covers last year and worked it, and it sort of just went off to the side because it's just such a big important thing and so expensive, but clearly the numbers don't support continuing to do what we've been doing, and times have changed and we need to change too. So I appreciate your indulgence and your information.
Through the chair, Captain Falvey, Senator Wilkins, you know, talking about the Southeast plan, documents that I've read in my office from those that were there prior to me did indicate that things would get more expensive while these roads and shuttle ferries were built, and you still had the requirement to run the mainliners to keep the system intact as these pieces were all being put together. And I believe that was anticipated. It's just, it looks like going to take an awful lot longer than we thought. And I think the question, too, is some of these shuttle links, you know, the fast ferries, the reason for the fast ferries was because of the distance between some of these links would not be possible to run them in a 12-hour day, 12-hour work rest rolls, without a faster boat. That's not to say that, you know, we need the high-speed code, that maybe we need a conventional fast ferry that would be much less expensive to operate. So.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I have a number of individuals who would like to ask questions. We'll go to Senator Cowdery now.
Yes. How much, what percentage of your operation is labor cost? And how many hours does a crew work before they get a break?
Vicki, I'm 60, I think labor is 62% labor costs.
And
the hours that a crew member might work depends on the vessel. Some of them are, the vessel might operate 24 hours a day where a crew member would be on there for a full 24 hours, but he might work 8 hours and then take his required Coast Guard time off, or 12 hours in some cases. And then, of course, the Lituya or the Fast Ferry are different hours on those, too. The Fast Ferries are 12, and the Lituya is right now 12 on a double shift on the boat, but probably would... We did have it running at 8 hours at one time.
Another follow-up. Senator Caldery. A few years ago, I've been on transportation for quite a while, there was talk of selling some of the ferries, and the argument was, well, the people, private sector, would cherry pick and then leave some routes that was unprofitable for you have to make. Have you ever did an analysis of what that unprofitable ones, how many dollars would that take to subsidize that versus what we're doing now?
Through the chair, Senator Cotter, I assume you mean selling, I think you said selling boats, but you're talking about selling the entire system or privatizing the system?
Well, I don't know that anybody would buy the entire system.
Okay.
And what I'm saying, Lynn Canal would probably be easy to get rid of and or to the private sector, and maybe some of the others. Has any thought been, about that lately?
One of our earlier plans was, as we brought a new ferry on, one would be sold or surplused. That was the case up till the Bartlett was the last one that was surplused and sold. And after that, we were looking at the Taku for that to be retired and sold from the fleet. The previous administration decided to keep the Taku and run it and keep it into the fleet, so we haven't went back to it. This slide, I believe, that Mr. Leary has up shows the routes that you might possibly want to, if you look all the way over to the total percent, you could see which ones that you could find somebody to buy, and you'd be lucky. Like the Chinigo at 17% is all she brings in on that particular scenario that's right there in the Lakani, where you look at the Malaspina, that's 71%. And so we have not done an analysis that I'm aware of on trying to parcel out the different routes to other entities. There's been talk about an authority. I believe, Senator, you might have had a bill in or talked about it to your committee, which has some promise to an authority, but we could never get past the fact of how would you get general fund money, assuming, you know, the system, the transportation system is not going to break even. It can be ran more efficient, and it can be some business principles adopted that could do some things that could change the general fund request. But overall, with the prohibition on one legislature binding another, you can't go out unless you would forward fund or put a pot of money out there, let's say $500 million, and say, you know, that's what you get for the next 10 years. That would be the only way an authority would work, as far as the money piece is concerned. So directly to your question, there hasn't been, that I'm aware of, an analysis on piecing out parts of it and selling parts, and then us keeping the more, the higher subsidy routes, I guess.
You've never put an inquiry out to see if anybody was interested in any part of the ferry system, private sector, and operate it? What part it wouldn't be interested? There's no takers?
Senator, I'm not aware of any. That doesn't. We went through different scenarios at different times, and engaged the private sector in providing the service. I can remember back when we thought we might have some labor issues and the system might not operate. And there was, I never saw the report, but I think they went out and talked to some folks about providing services. But I don't know of any that just straight on to answer your question that the state went out to try to piece out different portions of it in any kind of formal RFP or anything like that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Cowdery. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair. Again, looking at page 19 and trying to interpolate the information we're given here, we're looking at the service weeks, and a lot of the service weeks, like in the Chenega, you know, are very few. Of course, those go back over to the self-financing of the smallest percentage of total self-financing. I'm assuming that that's your way of trying to cut down on those boats because you know they're not making money, so you've got less service weeks in there. And maybe you can tell me if that's right or wrong and how I'm reading that. But, you know, I think it was very eye-opening, some of the conversation that Senator Wilkin put forth and maybe how some of those routes could work. If you could address how we could kind of, how do we look at the service weeks as compared to self-financing, maybe what the Alaska Marine Highway System has done to try and cut their expenses in the past to get where we're at now. You know, if we're looking at this, what have you done in the last 2 or 3 years to try and cut, you know, expenses or to keep expenses under control, I guess I should say. And also, and I'll just ask all my questions here, you can address them. With the, you touched a little bit on union issues. When I rode down on the Tustamina a couple of years ago and talked to the gentleman up there in the wheelhouse, that was their biggest problem that they had. You know, some of the workday sessions. Could you tell us a little bit about how that's going? And again, when I was going with the workday and service weeks, what do you do with the labor on some of these people where you only got 25 or 26 service weeks? What do you do with those personnel the rest of the time?
Dick, you want to start with explaining your chart?
Richard Leary. Representative, I think what I heard your first question was about controlling costs. Maybe we could focus on that for a bit. The labor contracts, once we did make the decision to put a boat in service, the labor contracts tell us what's going to happen as to what we're going to pay, how many people we're going to have on the boat. And the particular route then drives overtime. That constitutes about 62% of our costs. So once we make that decision to provide service, we're pretty well roped into paying an amount of money. It is beneficial to have enough people to draw on to be able to minimize that overtime function, which would get paid for week on, week off people who have to turn around and are called to work that second week. There's a premium paid for that. That is really, with the contracts that we have in place now, the area that management can hope to save money for 62 cents on every dollar. The fuel constitutes about 22 to 23% of the service that we have listed here. What we can do there is maintain the engines in proper good order and get the most efficiencies that we can. So when you add those two together plus risk management, the discretionary elements of spending are about 15, 18 cents on the dollar. A lot of that is food that we turn around and make a profit on, but the way we account for it, it's part of the expenditure and the revenue is up top. I guess what I'm trying to say is once we decide to provide service, there's very little control of operational costs. Where management does have discretion is administrative costs. And as was referenced earlier, security and added regulation has put quite an onus in the last 2 or 3 years on those areas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, a lot of the staffing on the vessels controlled by the Coast Guard. You know, they tell you what your minimum level is, minimum staffing, and then they also dictate on fire rescue and those how many additional folks you need besides the licensed officers, let's say. So the sailors and some of the stewards and so forth, if you had a vessel like the Columbia that has 500 people on board, you have to have a minimum level of staffing, whether or not you're carrying 100 people or whatever. So that's one of our drivers. On union issues itself, I think you're all aware that labor relations does the negotiations for, and the department is not. We're at the table, but primarily that's a function of the department administration on the labor negotiations. To my knowledge, there's none that have started yet, but on the contracts expire June of 07, I believe, along with a lot of other ones, and to my knowledge, there may have been some discussions, but I haven't been involved in them in my capacity as acting commissioner. The other question I think you had is what happens to the crews if we like the Columbia, and primarily where it's running 21 weeks, what happens to the other 30 for the crew? And there's a myriad of different answers. There's some crew that when the ship goes into the yard that work on the ship that will do some of the general maintenance and general fund CIP capital improvements that are funded by general fund. Some go out into the fleet and onto other vessels. Some take vacation and so forth. But that's basically, there's four or five things that they do. It's not directed necessarily by management of which way they go. And I will say, just for purposes, that a lot of these show not running the full 52 weeks, but the primary way that the system can save money. Now, we put a hiring freeze on a couple weeks ago, except for essential personnel that's required by Coast Guard. We're scrutinizing invoices over $1,000, have to have Captain Falvey or Richard Leary's approval, so that we're tightening it up as best we can that way on some fundamental business practices that we would probably all put into place in a situation like this. But fundamentally, that you to save money, that you have to tie the ships up. That's how you save money in the system, is not operating. And with that, you'll see all the different weeks and things up there. One of the things we're trying to do is put in a all-tied berth in Ketchikan, which would basically let us tie the vessels up and not have people on board to handle the lines as the tide goes up and down and in and out, and those kind of cost savings. But again, we can't implement those without having the federal funds or the funds for the construction to build those. So there are things happening, but they're kind of intertwined with other departments and other issues like federal funding and things.
Quickly, could you just list me two or three things that you've done in the last two or three years to substantially reduce your cost of operations?
Through the chair, Captain Falvey. I think Don Torgerson kind of summed it up for the most part. We are in the process of activating a new dispatch system. It's going to help us to dispatch our crews. We haven't done it yet, but it's coming, and it's very complex dispatching up to 1,000 Marine personnel. We get into certain overtime situations with our holdover and early callback because of the business rules that have to go into a dispatch. We are looking towards that dispatch system to help us considerably. As far as that goes, I mean, we look very closely at service weeks. As far as, let's say, for example, the fair weather, not running 7 days a week, for example, in the wintertime, and run 4 days a week and things like that. I think what
the fundamental answer again, we left ships in the shipyard longer, we tied them up longer, we didn't operate them as much. That's the primary thing that happened. Some were because of, like we talked about earlier, the status of the ships where they had overhauls and other things going on, we left them in there longer. The previous business plan of the previous administration was to run all the vessels, and they ran them a lot, and we see that with some of the other things that. So besides the scrutinizing invoices and some other things. I don't know if I can really give you an example other than leaving the ships tied up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Through the chair, Captain Falvey. I think what we do need to understand is it is very expensive to run ships. We are extremely federally regulated. Security is it's costing a fortune. Everyone that operates ships are, you know, being challenged by this. I have many contacts in the private marine world. You know, these companies are being challenged. The bottom line is very thin to try to make a buck. I don't know how many takers we would have if we tried to outsource. We have found that some of the outsourcing that we did and looked into was more expensive than running our own ships, believe it or not, through the private sector. It is very, very expensive to run ships. And fuel and labor, risk management, rules and regulations, it's all fixed. It's very hard for us to control that. I think the key is new tonnage. We do need some new tonnage that will be cheaper to operate. It'll be automated, it'll be less labor intensive, and less costly to repair.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was actually somewhat reluctant to ask a question after watching Senator Wilken at work. It's sort of like strolling up to the plate after Barry Bonds is hit. But I wanted to make sure that I'm not overinterpreting something that I thought I heard. I believe that somebody said in response to one of Senator Wilken's questions that there had been a recent study of the fare structures of the ferry system to make the pricing of services competitive with the private sector. That is, that you don't want the price of a ticket on the ferry from Sitka to Juneau, for instance, to be out of line with the price of an airline ticket from Sitka to Juneau. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, the report did compare costs and suggest rates that the Marine Highway would or could charge based upon cost of moving goods and services, one of which is airlines. The way you asked it, did we do it to airlines? And I don't think it was particularly just to an airline. The company, which was out of Seattle that actually did the work, compared it to BC Ferries. It compared it to Washington State Ferries and other systems. So they weren't just looking at ours in a vacuum. They looked at it on a per mile basis, a per subsidy basis, and some other things. I think Tom Briggs was the deputy commissioner at that time, implemented parts of that. I won't say he did the whole thing, and I can't remember which parts that he actually implemented, but he used that as a basis to set the rates, I guess in late 2004, that would have impacted fiscal year 05.
Okay, and just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, would the study then give us an idea of what at the time would have been the true cost for the ferry system of moving a passenger from Ketchikan to Juneau or you know, Sitka to Juneau or Bellingham to Skagway?
I don't remember all the details. I believe it did. I believe it was a chart similar to what we use for our traffic volume that you go across and down and it shows the price. But I don't remember.
I'm
glad to get that. I'll make sure all the members of the committee get that report because I'm sure we still have it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. I appreciate all the additional information. Mine is going to, my questions are more from an accounting perspective. I'm wondering if you could speak to a replacement account for your fleet and whether, according to Gadsby and the new accounting laws, whether we're handling depreciation and how we're handling it, and if we're moving depreciation and those costs into a real account that has real dollars for replacement of your fleet. And then, I don't need the answer today, but I'm wondering on our older fleet, it appears that the 1963 and 1964 fleet is actually functioning at a lower maintenance cost rate than the newer models and the faster fleet. So I was wondering if you could speak to if we have proven maintenance records on the investment in the fast ferry system versus the older ships. And then if you could speak to me, if we're considering replacement of our fleet, it appears that there's more profitability in carrying people than vehicles, at least by the purchases of the vessels that are on here. We start in 63 with passengers at 499 and a capacity to carry about 88 vehicles. And recently we've been purchasing transportation vehicles that can travel 149 in passengers and less in vehicles. So if you could speak to that management projection. And then this is purely education for a new member of this body. If you could tell me if our expenses remain the same in the winter versus the summer months, why we're not just running fewer ferries and running them year round versus and not dry docking a few or taking them off the fleet. So
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dick, you want to answer the GASB?
Yeah, depreciation. The boats that we have in the fleet are funded by federal dollars. Nancy, do you want to help me out here? But we don't have depreciation in our operating budget.
Mr. Chair, if I might, does GASB in regard to a federal purchase not require depreciation? I know that our road system requires depreciation.
Excuse me, for the chair, for the record, Nancy Slagle, Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. For accounting purposes, for financial reporting purposes, certainly we are required to show the value of our vessels and depreciation. There is a replacement fund that is in statute. It is not funded at this point in time. That fund is created and funded through appropriations by the legislature from the general fund, and there has not been any appropriations to that fund for quite a while. So there's not a connection between the reporting on the financial in our financial the CAFR, the Combined Annual Financial Report, and money appropriated in the replacement fund.
Mr. Chair, if I might follow up. About 4 years ago, from a local perspective, we were going through and measuring the life expectancy left on all of our roadway system. And we were having to account for that. And that accounting and how we used depreciation contributed to our, in the financial market, to our bond rating, basically, or how healthy we were in managing our system. And so maybe I'm comparing apples to oranges, but it seems that we have an investment in our fleet and that the federal government would require some kind of reporting in the same way to the ferry system. Is that not true? And I can go offline and get this separately if it's not of interest to others.
Through the chair, certainly, GASB 34 is a requirement for all the local communities as well as the state, so we are bound by that in our financial reporting. And so, yes, we do need to reflect that. There are a couple of different, and this is getting into the technical stuff, as you said, as to whether you do it on a modified basis. Or actual depreciation. So they are the two methods that you can use. And with us, the easiest way for us to deal with that is by reflecting some type of a depreciation. And that's how we've been showing in the CAFR, as I understand. And we can talk about that later.
I'll submit my other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Representative, I didn't get the rest. You were talking faster than I could write.
I'm sorry. You were allowed to present for 45 minutes for me to write the question.
I think your question had to do with number of vehicles or something of that nature.
It seemed that there was a tendency over the course and the life of the vessels that are currently in our fleet that we were moving in a ratio for less vehicles being transported. And I was wondering if it was a conscious decision of each administration as we went forward in purchasing, whether there was a trend that was associated to costs as to why we were doing that.
Thank you. believe the short answer is the fleet, the plans all call for us to do shuttle ferries, which are not mainline, which are smaller, faster, more efficient, less crew, and some other things. As we heard Captain Falvey say, that didn't exactly turn out that way on the fast ferries because of the cost of fuel. We knew how much fuel they would operate, but the expenses and some of the other things weren't exactly on target because of the fuel costs tripling or whatever they've done. So, and then the other part of the fast ferries was, at least not in my involvement earlier, I supported the fast ferries. I wanted them here. I fought another legislator on the floor to get the funding in there for them. But it was simply a fact that if we were going to do shuttles and we wanted to do something in a day, it took something to go faster than the conventional ferries. So what anybody wanted to call them fast ferries, I call them just faster ferries. But what happened through the process, the Coast Guard and others, is when they came up with the high-speed craft code. So now we have another class of sailors, masters, engineers, so forth. They have to be type-rated by the Coast Guard for that type of vessel. They can work on any other vessel in the fleet, but the rest of the fleet can't work on these vessels. It's only those, whatever, 10 people or whatever number that we have trained to do that. So unpredictable, at least from my perspective, those costs that we weren't that familiar with until the code was actually written and the Coast Guard passed off on what was going to be a high-speed craft.
Through the chair, Captain Falvey, just to kind of follow up, I think what has happened over the years is as these ships have been built, they were built to adjust to different routing that the system had and in capacity and whatnot. But I think it's also important to note that we have lowered the capacity legally on the COIs on all the ships because of security. Okay, above 499 passengers, we get into a MARSEC 2 level, which is a very heightened screening level, many more security patrols, extremely costly. It's a cost that we cannot sustain over the long haul. We do have agreements with the Coast Guard. If we do need to get on a certain route above 500 passengers, we can do it on a case-by-case basis, but we cannot afford to carry any more than 500 people because of the security rules and regulations and whatnot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Salmon?
Yes. I got a fairly simple question. I know there's a lot of good questions, but you don't hear really the true direction. In the paper the other day, indicated that this administration is going to go into a different direction. And my question lies is which different direction are we talking about? I mean, the way you look at this, the budget, or you know, you see your vehicles, aging vehicles, and you have all the routes you have to, and you have to increase your funding, and yet you know the funding is still limited. I almost basically understand what you guys are going through, you know, because in the aircraft business, you almost have to go through the same situation because of how the aircraft industry is regulated by the federal government, and so I don't know. The question I don't understand is whether you're going to be asking for more money, which will be the different direction, the different management style, which I basically heard, and more schedules, which people are asking for, which requires more money. Or a better, newer, more efficient ships. I mean, which direction do you think this new administration is going to be going?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative. I certainly don't have all the answers to those questions. I'll tell you that the Commissioner, as you heard, has just came on board. Will be heavily involved in what the new direction is going to be. Whether or not we know that fundamentally it comes back to the roads and the new shuttle ferries, which would be implementing the Southeast Plan. And I don't want to speak for the commissioner, but it's always been the plan to implement our goal, I should say, not to implement the Southeast plan. And with that would come, we all anticipate smaller boats, less crews, less expense to operate, more efficiency. Until we get there, you have the choices that we laid out earlier on what level of funding is brought forward, what the level the legislature wants to fund them at, and how would you reduce those levels. We are in a, as I said earlier, this budget request that we have up there, the $98 million for this year, is being, because DOT is going to take a $21 million reduction in its general fund request, the Marine Highway System will be a part of that. To what level or to what degree, I'm not prepared I don't know today. It's just something that the folks have been working on in their respective duties and are compiling that, and then it'll go to the governor or whoever to make those decisions. So I know that sounds like a political answer. It was. I don't have the actual facts and figures that I can share with you at this point.
Thank you. You want to follow up?
Just a small follow-up, short one. First of all, I just don't want to be, labeled that I'm, against the ferry system, I think without the ferry system, you might as well shoot Juneau in the head or, all of these villages that surrounding the Juneau area, you might as well shoot them in the head without the ferry system, because a lot of them don't even have airports. So, to me, it's a system, it's a worthwhile system, if you look at it in the long run.
Well, and through the chair, we realize we have routes that are never anywhere near break even, but just for what you said, it is a major transportation link to move goods and services in and out of there, and that's our mission, that's our goal. We want to do that as efficiently and effectively as we can, and basically that's what we present to you today.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. I have one suggestion and one question. Having been stuck in Sitka for the last two Mondays, I think a Monday morning ferry from Juneau to Sitka to Juneau may be very profitable.
Best ferry.
Yeah. My question is, are there any studies on the economic impacts of the Marine Highway System? Studies in terms of the indirect jobs that it creates or the overall economic impact? In other words, I guess if we did cut the Marine Highway System, what would be the impact to the Alaskan economy? Are there any studies or research?
To the chair, the answer is yes. I can't quote you many facts and figures from there, but McDowell has been two or three that I know over the last maybe 5 or 10 years that McDowell Group has. Each region, like Southeast region itself, has done some through their staff members and their economists and so forth, but we can certainly get you those. And again, depending on the level of reduction would be the impacts of what might happen, which we don't know at this point, but we'll get you those studies.
Okay, thank you. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair. And I'm going to ask this question on behalf of my friend from Beaver here. He's been asking this question the last few years, so I'm going to ask it for him this year. Have you ever done any cost analysis or to see how many people would be served to have some type of a ferry system on the Yukon River or somewhere in interior Alaska to see how many people would be served there and how it would work?
Through the chair, I'm not aware of any. That actually would lay it out similar to what we're doing here on what a subsidy might be or how many people you move. I know that they've had that. I mean, Utana Barge Lines runs used to carry passengers, but I there may be something through that organization, but I don't know of any on whether or not.
Thank you, Chair.
Any studies?
I'd just like to make a comment to his. Back in the 60s, they did a study, and and right now I got a bill to do another study, which it's not, hopefully it goes somewhere.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looks like we have about 10 minutes left in the meeting, so I wanted to get this this out. I have a first a comment and then a question. Senator Wilken brought up quite a few points that we've been wrestling in this building for quite a few years, and since he's been sitting in this seat when it's been finance, he's been the one that people have been tugging on his coat quite a bit. So I can appreciate the frustration that he feels with how the system's going. On the other hand, I believe, as Senator Torgerson mentioned, it's not nearly as cut and dry as taking the numbers that were put out on the table and simply making a decision based on that. There are many, many different factors that go into what this system means to the state and the influences on the costs and the benefits to that system. So if you do come back with the numbers, or when you do come back with the numbers the senator has requested, it would be very beneficial for all the members to see some of the different factors that have gone into those changes. We serve, correct me if I'm wrong, quite a few more communities than we did 20 years ago when we were talking about how much things cost back then. And that's a benefit to the state. And I just wanted to get that out there. My question is Marine Transportation Advisory Board, something that's come up in the last, it was in a an order from the previous administration, and I'm wondering if the new governor is moving in that direction to have that that entity again, and how did that work from your perspective managing the system? How did you interact with MTAB, and has that interaction changed over the last couple of years, and do you support re-implementation of that entity?
Mr. Chairman, I'll take the first part of that question. We have requested that the governor consider reinstituting MTAB, and my understanding is they're working on that, and there may be, well, I don't know where it's at in the process, but my understanding is it's being considered by her and the administration as far as doing that. From my perspective of working with MTAB, as any committee, you get bogged down details of things and get kind of left and right, but I thought they brought a lot of, they're the users of the system, they're experienced in the system. We might have been able to use a few more business minds, but we had some on there. I might have changed the makeup a little bit, but I personally enjoyed working with all the folks that were on MTAB during the period of time that I was working with them. Captain Falvey?
Yep. Captain Falvey, through the chair, I think that they do have a place. I think that they can help us decide maybe the bigger picture as opposed to, getting into the weeds per se. Maybe help us determine service levels, core service, for example, like we talked about. Do we run to this port? Do we not run to that port? That's the kind of help I think the MTAP could give us, and I think that's important, and it's important to work closely with them.
Follow up. And MTAB, Marine Transportation Advisory Board, made up of stakeholders of folks that use the system, and I saw the commissioner had to duck out early. He had another meeting, but I hope you'd carry the message back that it's very important, I think, to us to have these stakeholders have a place at the table. I'm not sure what the new order, if it comes, will look like, but from our perspective, I think it's important to have the stakeholders.
And pass that on.
And the last thing before I give up the mic, I was happy to hear Senator Wilken talk about a solution to the long-term problem that he sees, and I look forward to when we do bring road projects in front of the Senate in the future that I'm certainly sure we'll have good discussions with the senator about accomplishing some of those things.
Could I have your indulgence to tell a story while we have Senator Torgerson at the table?
Oh,
just so you know, just so you know, Captain, who you're dealing with and what he does. There was a battle royal, as Nancy remembers and Bob remembers, about the fast ferries here at this very table. And Senator Torgerson was at the end of the table. And so there was this, 5 years ago, this discussion about how we were classifying fleets and we had the old ships and all that. So Senator Torgerson, in his infinite wisdom, issued one of the lasting legislative definitions when he said, so what we're going to have is we're going to have the fast ferries, and then we're going to have the half-fast ferries. And you started talking, I remembered that. And so anyway, I offer that up for whatever good it is, other than we'll leave it at that.
With that, I want to tell you that with 5 minutes of three, I know most of the members have schedules that they need to keep to, and we don't want to keep anybody over. I want to thank the commissioner for being here. I realize he did have to leave early for another meeting. I want to thank the staff of the Marine Highway System. You did a wonderful job for us today. Any material that you have that you want to present to the rest of the committee, if you would give it to either Representative Johansson or myself or our staff, we'll make sure it gets distributed, and we appreciate it. So on behalf of the Transportation Committee in the Senate and Transportation Committee in the House, thank you very much for the presentation. And with that, we're going to close the meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.